Excellent. And the weather today for the Lincoln region, highs of 12 degrees centigrade, lows of 7 degrees centigrade. It's going to be a cloudy and cool day with outbreaks of rain or drizzle. So, we talked about the yes-no vote and how British folk can't stop saying no with Ian Lennox, our writer, before the news. He was interested to find out where the results, the research came from. It was the Almond Board of California. And now to hopefully address these key quandaries in our modern life in which 88% of British folk are sacrificing things that make them happy, we're delighted to actually speak to somebody who always makes us happy because she's just an all-round wonderful broadcaster and general ace nutritionist. It's Lucy Jones. How are you, Lucy?
Good morning, and thank you for the very nice intro.
Very important that we maintain our positivity. In terms of this particular research that, you know, Britain is being gripped by modern guilt and so on, I mean, you know, so often we're running features about how you need to reduce your alcohol intake, you need to avoid snacks between meals, you need to eat healthily and so on. Is this not just the kind of natural response that actually we're doing it, but we're kind of doing it with a heavy heart?
Yeah, I think you're right, and I'm quite worried about that, because actually if 9 out of 10 of us are sacrificing the things that we enjoy, there's a good chance that actually we can't maintain that. Eventually we're going to give up. And, you know, it all comes from a good place. People are much more interested in their lifestyles, their health, and they appreciate the impact of their choices on their long-term health and well-being, and they're trying to do the right thing.
And in terms of that whole element, we want to obviously live well, live longer lives, live better qualities of lives and so on. Getting that balance, you know, as many a Buddhist philosopher will actually say, can be perhaps the most challenging thing for us.
It can, and certainly if we look at the things that this research has flagged that people are avoiding, it's things like takeaways, it's snacking, it's drinks at the pub. People are trying to make sure that they're exercising, they're getting enough sleep, they're having healthy, balanced meals. But it could be argued that perhaps we're not quite getting the balance right. I always describe it as, imagine you've got a rubber band and you're holding it really far apart with two fingers and you're stretching it as tight as it can go. And of course you can't maintain that. It's either going to snap or you're going to get tired and you're going to let go. And it's exactly the same with our lifestyle. We call it flexible restraint. You've got to be able to actually enjoy the things that you love as well as making balanced choices, because otherwise it's just not going to be sustainable for the long term.
Well, from the good news department, it's pleasing to see that the humble almond may well be a way of actually ensuring that there is such a thing as a healthy snack.
Absolutely. So this research flagged up that 40% of people are trying to avoid snacking between meals. And I think there's huge confusion with snacks, where a lot of people are actually feeling guilty about snacking. And for me, snacking can be an incredibly positive part of maintaining good health and a healthy weight. And if you look at something like almonds, it's calorie controlled. They actually are a very good source of protein and fiber and essential vitamins and minerals. And the evidence shows that if you have them as a snack, say mid-morning, you actually end up eating less at lunch and then dinner, not intentionally, just because they're helping you to feel full. So you actually are empowered to make healthier, balanced choices for the rest of the day. So they can actually become a real tool in your makeup of trying to make healthy, balanced choices through your life.
It's interesting that in terms of gender balance, the survey revealed that more men feel guilty about drinking too much alcohol than women. However, more women feel guilty about eating an unhealthy meal than men. So I don't know what that says about sort of where we kind of position ourselves from that point of view. But as you just mentioned, in terms of almonds, they are a way in which if you keep a supply of those there, they can presumably stave off the hunger pangs and also kind of give you that glow of saying, well, actually, I'm being true to myself here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the more things we can get to actually make us feel empowered that we're doing this for the right reason rather than feeling guilty about everything and pressured into saying no to all the things we enjoy, well, it's got to be a good thing. And even with the humble almond, we don't have to make it boring, actually. There's a variety of things you can do with it. If you fancy a sweet treat, mix it with something like dark chocolate and dried cranberries. If you fancy something spicy and savoury, coat it in some paprika or some spices and bake it. You can do really nice things with them to keep it interesting and something to enjoy rather than feeling like another thing that is the daily grind of healthy living.
Wearing your dietitian's hat, Lucy, would you say that actually snacking is a good thing, or is it something which, again, you know, there's, because we've heard, again, conflicting rumours, conflicting sources of information. Some people say, no, you should have 3 square meals a day, and the whole notion of breakfast like a king and supper like a pauper and so on is there. Would you actually say that snacking is to be encouraged?
Do you know, I think we're always trying to find this black and white of what we should do and what we shouldn't do, and the answer is that there are so many different ways to eat well, and snacking can certainly be a healthy addition to a diet. So for some people, eating 3 square meals a day might work perfectly well. For other people, they get hungry and actually struggle to meet their nutrient needs when they're only eating 3 times a day. And for those people, snacking is so helpful. And, you know, if you're having a balanced snack that's helping you to stay full and make healthy choices, then I'd say don't feel guilty about it at all. It's actually a really positive difference to be making to your health. Just remember, there's a big difference between a snack and a treat. A snack is making a positive contribution to your daily diet. A treat is something to be savoured and enjoyed. Still don't feel guilty, but, you know, stick it to once or twice a week so it's not throwing the balance off.
Indeed. Do you have a favourite snack yourself, Lucy? You can say almonds if you wish, but if there's another one that springs to mind, would you say there's one that you would go to?
I'm a girl of variety. I like mixing my snacks every day. So, yeah, I do love almonds, and I also love almond butter. I love sticking it on some crackers. I really enjoy yogurts and sprinkling seeds and crushed nuts and dried fruits into it. I really like hummus with some seeded crackers. I think actually having a good variety of snacks at your disposal helps you to stay on track.
And in terms of finding out further information about this survey from the Almond Board of California, where's the best place you'd recommend people to go to?
I'd head over to their website, actually, because you can get all the research, you can get all the nutritional facts, but you can also get all those recipes to actually make really interesting combos and flavours. So that's www.almonds.co.uk.
That's wonderful. I did like the finding that those aged between 35 and 44 are the biggest gym bunnies, with 41% prioritising exercise over social commitments.
That age where we all become aware of our mortality.
We don't want to go into midlife crisis. That's a whole new story. Lucy, 2 final questions for your good soul. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting and positive telephonic link with us on the programme this morning? Has it been okay for you?
It's been wonderful. Really nice to catch up.
Well, then hopefully we can connect with you again in the not-too-distant future and keep us appraised of matters to do with nutrition and more. Lucy Jones, will you be kind enough to return?
I will indeed.
Yay! Silence me, leaving no Yes. Say Yes. That's the band. Wondrous Stories was their tale. And it's a wondrous story here as far as Siren Radio is concerned, because don't forget, this evening we have the Stone Tapes, which is jam-packed full of wondrous stories between 7:02 and 8:00 here on Siren Radio. Coming up, we'll be speaking to Paul Nelson from the World Travel Market, in which we'll be addressing that issue about news and weather agendas and how they've affected our travel plans this year. Trump, hurricanes, referendums, the Trump slump, Catalonia's bid for independence, Hurricane Harvey. How can we put a positive spin on that? Stay tuned to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. We'll find out with Paul Nelson from the World Travel Market in a matter of moments. In fact, immediately after Bruce Springsteen and his Streets of Philadelphia.
I was bruised and battered, I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. Saw my reflection in a window and didn't know my own face. Oh brother, are you gonna leave me wasting away on the streets of Philadelphia? Stone. I heard the voices of friends vanished and gone. At night I could hear the blood in my veins, just as black and whispering as the rain on the streets of Philadelphia.
Somber tone, maybe echoing the feeling that folk have had over 2017, where referendum, hurricanes, Trump, whole variety of things have impacted the World's Travel Market Industry Report 27 in a negative way. Let's find out more details. Let's put some flesh on the bones by actually talking about this issue with ace consultant extraordinaire Paul Nelson from the World's Travel Market. Hello, Paul. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Good morning.
Marvellous. Now let's talk about news and weather. I mean, clearly you see news about a hurricane, you see a president who's elected, you think, I don't know where we're going here. You might well sort of say, don't think we'll go to Philadelphia this year, or maybe we won't go to Catalonia this year. Is this borne out by the fact that in terms of tourist activities, we're seeing substantial drops in local regions and so on?
We're not seeing drops by any means. I mean, the travel industry is growing predominantly. There'll be something like 30 million holidays and trips taken from around the world by the time we get to 2020. And from a UK perspective, you're looking at 66 million trips, or 66 million holidays that take place every year. The problem that we have now is, of course, it's so competitive. So down at World Travel Market between the 6th and 8th of November, there will be 182 countries and regions that will be signing £3 billion worth of industry deals. And those deals are effectively the contracts that will turn into the holidays and the packages that where you and I and your listeners will all be going on holiday next year and in the future. So there's just so much competition now that then when something hits the news, such as, you know, Trump and some of Trump's policies that might turn people off the US, and that becomes a benefit to another country. So as an example, Canada's doing really well off the back of that, Mexico as well. And it just plays a kind of a domino effect. So it's just all around the world, just like from the closer to home. You know, we've had the terrorist incident that we had, unfortunately, in Tunisia, which then meant people couldn't go to Tunisia. We had similar issues there with Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. So that capacity was moving to other destinations such as Italy and Greece and Spain, those more safer destinations, I guess, that us British travellers viewed them as being safe. And now we've got Tunisia, where we can fly back to Tunisia again, and Tunisia is going to be at WTM World Travel Market this year, really pushing the fact that the country is open for business and it's safe to travel again. So yeah, so it's just so much competition, you know, to get us to travel to different countries.
It's intriguing that when we were talking with colleagues about the fact that Donald Trump's presidential election made 27% of holidaymakers say that they're less likely to visit the United States, people were surprised it was actually so low a number. I might have thought it would have increased on that system. But is the message that's coming across here, Paul, one that actually you need to be aware of what's happening in terms of the headlines? We do live in a global village, as McLuhan said. And actually, at the same time, as long as you take sensible precautions and so on, you need to effectively decide where you're going to go, where you're going to have your holiday, given information that you have to hand.
Yeah, very much so. And the Foreign and Commonwealth Office does some really great advice. I mean, that's a department within the government that will decide whether we can and cannot fly to a country and how safe it is. But at the same time, alongside that, whether, you know, when it stops us from flying, it also just offers really good general advice as to how you should behave when you're in different resorts and how certain behaviour will go down with, you know, with the locals and while you're in resorts. So yeah, we have to be aware of that. And I would advise all holiday makers, regardless of where you're going, even if you're going to somewhere you've been before, like a Spain or a Greece or a Turkey, to, you know, just go on the website and just check out what it's recommending, because the advice there is really good.
I'm going to be speaking in a few moments to the Deputy Director of the German Tourist Board, Jeanette Schochmann. From your own predictions, Paul, where do you think people are likely to be moving? I mean, I know it's a bit like saying, oh, you know, let's seek the oracle of Paul Nelson to find out where people are going to go to in the world travel market. Is it going to be more long-ranging distances? Are people going to be more prone to staycations? What are your kind of general gut feelings at this stage?
I think we've seen, certainly from our research, that Italy is going to be a very popular country. So we polled both holidaymakers as well as polling our delegates, in effect. So they're the businessmen that are deciding, you know, who they're going to be talking to next this year at WTM for holidays for next year. And Italy came out top of both polls. So it certainly seems that Italian products will be very, all over our shelves as far as next year is concerned, and all over the websites. Greece as well was very popular. I think you see Tunisia come back. There was a real desire from the buyers within the travel industry to start purchasing Tunisian product now that it's a country that the UK can fly back into again. So from a short-haul perspective, they'll probably be the winner. Spain is always going to be popular. Long-haul, as I said, Canada is really doing well, particularly its cities. So that's seeing a real resurgence. Mexico is another one. Cancun is growing in popularity, but the Mexican Tourist Board is involved in a kind of long campaign, which is to get people to see Cancun, but also to see the kind of the real Mexico, what it's like to live like a Mexican, in effectively, so taking out to the villages and all around the country. So that's doing really well. So I think we'll see movement to those countries. They're doing really well, but it'll be long haul and it will be short haul. We were just talking earlier, actually, from the Brits' desire to travel, regardless of what Trump says from within the White House or what terrorism takes place, is just there. You know, how important it is for us to have our 2 week summer holiday and to get away from everything, get that sun in and also have a few mini breaks as well. So yeah, we'll definitely still be traveling.
And from a personal point of view, do you have any particular favorite locations? Are you going to shock the listener by saying, personally, I always like to go to Skegness?
my favorite country is probably Croatia. So I was in Dubrovnik this summer. I've been to Dubrovnik a few times. I've also been to Split and Zagreb. And when you go to Dubrovnik and to Split, there's quite literally hundreds of islands. So you can just do loads of island hopping off the coast, and each island has its own kind of unique feel, its own unique culture in many ways. So my favourite place, my recommendation, would be Croatia.
And for folk who are keen to find out further information about this whole scenario, including possibly our construction workers who have returned, which is very nice, where would you suggest they should actually go to online to find out further details?
Go to the WTM London website, so that's WTMLondon.com.
Paul, as ever, it's been a delight with your good self. I'm mindful of the days of the 1970s, etc., where you feel as though we almost had a radio station in a Spanish hotel that was being built. Those days have long since gone, but I'm sure they'll get the thing sorted through. Paul, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning? Has it been okay for you?
It's been lovely. Thanks very much.
And in which case, hopefully we'll connect again in the very near future to find out more from world travel and so on. Excellent stuff.
Take care. Thanks very much.
Sings white Christmas. He makes you feel nice. December baby, the magic began. Oh, Saint Nicholas up the chimney, just a poppy glove in my memory. Ooh, drop it down in my parachute. The candle lights.
still not out of October and he's playing December tunes. Oh well, Kate Bush, December will be magic again. Beginning to set the scene for a focus on the upcoming Christmas market scenario. Yes, over the next couple of weeks, Christmas markets up and down the country will be opening their doors, but we will actually be talking about the authenticity of a real German market, all being well, with Brandenburg's spokesperson Regina Zibel and Deputy Director of the German Tourist Board, Jeanette Schuchmann. All this and more once we've actually had Kate Bush doing her December Will Be Magic Again. I think it's time we maintained a back to December line with Taylor Swift. It's 9:29 on Siren Radio, Lincoln's first community radio station.
I'm so glad you made time to see me. How's life? Tell me, how's your family? I haven't seen them in a while. You've been good, busier than ever. With small talk, work and the weather. Your guard is up and I know why. Cause the last time you saw me is still burned in the back of your mind. You gave me roses and I left them there to die.
Certainly over the last 15 years, Christmas markets have been sprouting up across the country. We've got the Lincoln Christmas Market, we've got the Birmingham Christmas Market, we've got cities vying to declare their own Christmas market the most popular. But at the same time, whilst embracing the local market is one thing, there's still nothing better than the authenticity of a real German market. To talk about this and more, we're delighted to welcome the Brandenburg spokesperson extraordinaire, Regina Zibel. Good morning. Guten Morgen, Regina.
Good morning, Alex.
And equally wonderful Deputy Director of the German Tourist Board, Jeanette Schuchmann. Good morning, Jeanette.
Guten Morgen.
Excellent. Ausgezeichnet. Let's progress. Let's move on to this whole notion of the best way to build up to a Fröhlicher Weihnachten, the whole aspect of a German market in Germany. So if we can come to you first, Regina, talk us through why Brandenburg is the place to head to this year if you're interested in experiencing an authentic German market.
Well, I think many British people go to Berlin and, you know, they don't know that Potsdam is so close to Berlin. It's just 30 minutes by train away, and there you go. You have a beautiful historic city with quite a few Christmas markets, different ones. We have even international Christmas markets, like, for instance, the Bohemian, the Polish Christmas market. We have a first Russian Christmas market this year, and a Dutch Christmas market. So quite a few, and all offer special products from their home countries, in addition to the typical German Christmas market products, as they are bratwurst or mulled wine or gingerbread. So I think that is worth a visit.
I was quite staggered to find that there are between 3,000 and 5,000 Christmas markets in Germany, and Berlin has actually got 60 of those. This is a phenomenal line, Jeanette, in terms of, I mean, you could barely move in Germany, presumably, for Christmas markets.
You can't. You're absolutely right. It certainly is. Every town has their own Christmas market. They have their own tradition. I think it started probably hundreds of years ago, in fact, in Frankfurt, in Nuremberg, in Dresden, and in other places, especially near the Polish border, where people just wanted to have something before the winter starts, before it gets really cold and you can't go out anymore. And so this tradition grew over the years. It was, it grew. I think when I was a kid, it was a special thing to go to the Christmas markets. Now everybody goes after work. It's very much a local thing as well. It isn't just for tourists, but it's for the locals as well to have a really good time and just have a little bit of Christmas cheer before it actually gets to the hard stuff at 24th.
We talked about the range of Christmas markets. So we've got organic, eco-friendly markets in Berlin, a maritime Christmas market in Emden. Let's go back to Brandenburg, if we can. Obviously, we're familiar with the Brandenburg Concerto. We're familiar with the musical history of the region and so on. Regina, where does Brandenburg actually sort of stand out as being just that little bit extra as far as Christmas markets are concerned?
Well, I mean, if you leave Berlin and go to Potsdam, you can experience quite a bit of culture. We have the Prussian palaces and gardens. The most popular one of the palaces is Sanssouci. You might have heard of Sizilienhof, and there are quite a few others. And in addition to that, we have, since 2017, actually, a very new attraction, which is the Barberini, the Potsdam Art Museum, which has had only this year already 400,000 visitors. So that is a new popular attraction in Potsdam.
And clearly there might be listeners who will have gone to the Lincoln Christmas Market, they might have gone to the Birmingham Christmas Market and so on. We'll keep doing some more location reports from that. But if you've got somebody who actually has never been to a Christmas market, what advice would you give them? We'll go to Jeanette for this. I mean, what advice would you provide Jeanette for somebody who's actually thinking, shall I not, etc.? What should they do?
Well, they say there's nothing but the real thing, of course. That's one thing. But go hungry, because there's so many different foods, local specialities. I mean, apart from the grilled sausages, either you can have them hot and spicy or with mustard. They've got the mulled wine, of course. In Frankfurt, they have cider. In Potsdam, they probably have mulled wine, proper wine, red wine or white wine. They've got all different sweets. I think Stollen is very popular in this country as well. But that's just one of the sort of Christmas sweets you would get. But gingerbread is very famous as well. So go hungry.
Nicely thought, and also a way of actually ensuring that you can make the selection browsing, I find, is very useful as you work through the whole system there. I have to mention, of course, the tallest Christmas tree in Germany can be seen in Dortmund, so lots of great stuff there. But where can people actually find out further information about Christmas markets in Germany, and indeed the best way forward to access the details, Jeanette?
Okay, it's brandenburg-tourism.com, and of course for the whole of Germany, it's germany.travel.
Well, we refuse to actually play any Christmas theme songs at this particular stage, because I think it's far too early from that point of view. But I think in terms of actually heading towards the Christmas market scenario, you've both actually sold me on the whole process. It's wonderful. To Regina Zibel, Brandenburg spokesperson extraordinaire, and Deputy Director of German Tourist Board, Jeanette Schuchmann, many thanks indeed.
Just follow the sea.
course, to employ a well-known maxim, sci-fi London is for life, not just for Christmas. Isn't that right, Louis Savvy?
Good morning.
Marvellous. Very good indeed. You know, I'm looking ahead to, obviously, Sci-Fi London 2018, and we're sort of just mapping out things for that. And then I find there's magical things happening in the very near future, between the 3rd and the 5th of November, in this very year of 2017, where we have Sci-Fi London experiment with all manner of things happening. Louis, what's taking place in London? Why should we be making a beeline to the capital for this grand weekend?
Well, it's we found this little oasis in the middle in East London for those who are nerdy and geeky and love their sci-fi and their games and their films, and it's called EXP, and it's on the canal just behind the Olympic Stadium, so it's very easy to get to, and the place is full of all the consoles that you can imagine. PlayStations, Xboxes, old Nintendos, old Ataris. It's full of high-spec brand new LAN PCs. It's got every computer and console game you can imagine in the building on site for you to play with. It also has an enormous area for tabletop games. So there is everything from, you know, Catan and Doggle and you name it. It's an amazing place. You can come down and play games also. But then beyond that, there's a bar. You can, you know, buy a burger and a beer and go and sit and play your games. And we're turning it into a pop-up cinema at the same time, bringing in some live music, bringing in some lightsaber dueling, bringing in all sorts of manners of tournaments. We've got brand new games launching at the event. It's going to be a crazy weekend.
I'm particularly interested about the cyber dog founders. Is this K9 having his time in the sun, perhaps?
It's Vincent Jonet. I think you've met Vince, actually, at the festival before. And every year he makes me a crazy hat or a beautiful sculpture out of old junk. And he's a great believer in that nothing is really waste. You know, everything can be composted, or it can be used for other things. But he's also an artist, so he has a science background, and he was one of the early founders of the Cyberdog organization, and he's coming down to basically run some, I say they're workshops, some junk shops, really. He's going to be playing around ripping old computers apart, old components, anything that's got a motor in it or a laser, you know, old CD players and all that sort of stuff, and then turning them into sculpture. But what is great is he makes them live because, you know, they've got batteries and stuff inside, so all the motors still work and all that kind of stuff. And then, so we're inviting people to come down and just have a play around with him, you know, and just build some artifacts of the future.
I would challenge somebody who actually built into their robotic programs the words, no disassemble.
Exactly.
You could actually incorporate that into one of the quiz questions, because you've also got the SFL Sci-Fi London quiz, you've got talks on sci-fi filmmaking, and you've also got, as described by the wonderful Dara O'Brien, the genius of Nate Crowley.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So Nate started this thing as a joke, basically, saying to people, you know, come up on Twitter, come up with an idea for a game that you'd like to see made, you know, that doesn't exist at the moment. And it just went crazy, and he got so many ridiculous examples. And of course, you know, being 9:30 in the morning on a Thursday, I can't remember one of them now. Good radio, this.
All wondrous. We can go to the website
exactly,
and sort out details
exactly.
There. Go to scifilondon.com and see these things.
Know, exactly. But he did this little thing as a joke online, and it went viral, and he's got hundreds and thousands of these crazy game ideas. So what he said was that he'll try and make one of the games from it as well. And so he's put a book together all about the journey of this stuff, and he's going to be down there talking about it more eruditely than I am, certainly. But it's very funny. It's really funny to see what people came up with.
You've got
outside spaces, you've got the Swan Wharf, you've got Tabletop Fun, you've got a variety of other things. One minor caveat we need to acknowledge: there isn't a stair lift, or indeed, there are lots of stairs, but there isn't a lift, so you need to bear in mind that's a challenge.
Exactly, there's lots of stairs. Unfortunately, there's no wheelchair access. It's a very old warehouse, and they're new in the building, so once they've established themselves, they said that they may well start to look at...
They'll build a lift in, which is exactly what our construction workers have been doing all morning outside the Siren Studio. They've gone quiet now. Obviously, they're listening to you, Louis, which is marvellous. That's great stuff. Tickets for this routine, a three-day pass, a mere £28. It's wonderful stuff there. Single day, £15. And children, actually, under 16, will go free. There are also student tickets available. It's just a wondrous event.
Yeah, should be a lot of fun. Should be a lot of fun. We've got some great film on as well. I mean, Blade Runner's great. Thor is opening, tonight pretty much nationwide. And those films are all fabulous and fantastic. But, the one thing we do try and do is bring you those gems that you're not going to be able to see at the cinema, because Blade Runner and Thor and the likes of those films are all in the way. They get such publicity and such a push to the cinema that you're going to miss some of the, absolute gems that are out there.
And you might sort of have not heard of Justice League, a little movie that comes out in mid-November, but, there are other things that are actually around.
You'll be able to see that any day of the week for a couple of months, and then it'll be on, Netflix or the TV or DVD or whatever else, within another 2 months. But a film like Embers, for instance, which we had at our festival 18 months, a couple of years ago, still hasn't had a release here. And it's a fantastic film, absolutely. Debut film from a woman director from Brooklyn called Claire Carey. It's a spectacular piece of cinema. But unfortunately, there just isn't the capacity to bring all this, to release this stuff to the general public. So,
and Louis, that is one of the reasons why, as I've just you agreed there, basically there will be a knighthood in the forthcoming future honours list sometime for yourself for services to science fiction film. It has to happen. It's our way forward. Louis, it's been sensational as ever. Touchy Rich with yourself. A reminder, you can go to scifilondon.com to find out about Experiment, this great event between the 3rd and 5th of November. Playback podcast, if you want to find out more details from that perspective. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
As always, sir.
So, actually, would you be around the day before the festival, i.e. next Thursday, the 2nd of November, for a final little tease ahead to this grand event?
Yeah, we can do that. Well, there may be a few other things that we've added by then.
Exactly.
As well,
right? We might even have some midweek drive-outs who are so exhausted these days, Louis. We were joined earlier by the author of the Treknology column in the Star Trek Monthly, Chris Dowes. He had to go off to do some teaching. It's outrageous in a university, I think. I mean, we're off, we're going doing these sort of things. Anyway, that's what we're traditional on that basis, the home of Siren FM at the University of Lincoln. But we will connect with you again, hopefully, in about 168 hours from now.
Lovely.
Yay!
Fantastic. All right, good stuff. Thank you.
Run down 80s car, headed out to God knows where. this is too far. He's gonna change, gonna change his ways. Gonna change, gonna change his ways. And it feels like his new life can start. And it feels like
antibiotics, the importance of ensuring that you take full courses and developing various other aspects. It's a kind of constant war thing that we've been having, humanity and viruses and so on, and infectious diseases and microbiology. Well, again, taking antibiotics when you don't need them does put you and your family at risk. And to address some of the challenges being faced today in Britain by the whole range of antibiotics that are actually out there, we're delighted to welcome healthcare epidemiologist and consultant infectious diseases and microbiology from Public Health England, Susan Hopkins. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
So, 5,000 deaths are caused each year in England, on an estimate, because antibiotics no longer work for some infections. It's not just a case of mutations occurring, but clearly this report from Public Health England, 4 in 10 patients with an E. coli bloodstream infection cannot be treated with the most commonly used antibiotics in hospitals. Are we losing the war, Susan?
So I think we've got good things and bad things happening at the moment. So increasing resistance has happened year on year over the last 10 years. And we have been targeting GPs and hospital doctors for the last 3 to 4 years to get them to reduce their antibiotic use, only prescribing when absolutely necessary. And they've done that really well. So GPs have reduced antibiotics by 13% over the last 3 years. But now we're targeting the public. We want people to realise that when they go to their GP's surgery and they've got a cough or a sore throat, that if the GP doesn't think they need an antibiotic, then that's the right decision. So taking their doctor's advice. We all need to take personal responsibility for this.
OK, let's bring in Lauren Wood. Lauren, a third-year student in reading public relations, you're down with flu bugs, etc. You said you were taking antibiotics and they're working.
Yeah, they definitely are working. My symptoms are reducing.
So was that, presumably that was recommended by your doctor when you went to see him or her and they sort of said they prescribed your course?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, just returning to yourself, Susan, is it a case that obviously that Lauren continues the course, wraps the whole thing through from that point of view, or should she actually sort of, again, there was the confusing advice a few weeks back that suggested actually you don't really want to complete the course, you don't want to sort of go right to the end?
So we want people to take their doctor's advice. Doctors know how long they should give the patient's treatment and they will be able to advise each individual. Obviously, there are conditions that you need antibiotics for, but we want to preserve the antibiotics for those conditions and not use them when they're not necessary.
I was quite astounded by the statistic that in just over 30 years, so we're talking about just before 2050 actually emerges, antibiotic resistance will kill more people than cancer and diabetes combined. Is the prognosis positive from that? I mean, the Keep Antibiotics Working campaign is clearly there to ensure that, as you rightly said there, Susan, public trust their doctor, a nurse or indeed pharmacist's advice. But again, it's something we all need to be aware of, really.
It is. And I think, you know, we need new antibiotics to be developed, and that's part of it. But each new antibiotic, from developing it in the laboratory to actually delivering it to patients at the front end, takes about 20 years. So it's a very long process. And what we're seeing now is that every antibiotic that gets developed, within 2 to 3 years, we've got resistance. So it's a constant battle. The less we use them, the less resistance will emerge. And the solutions for the emergence of antibiotic resistance are for everyone to take them as little as possible, only take them as the doctor prescribes, and to use alternatives such as paracetamol, hot drinks, resting when you've got coughs, colds or flus.
Lauren, yes. Questions from yourself.
Do you have any advice on preventing getting ill in the first place? Like, you know, having a good diet, you know? These things.
Yeah, so I think the first things are to keep washing your hands, because we'll come across bacteria and viruses every day just by touching surfaces. So washing your hands regularly is a really important point. The second thing is a good diet is always important. Plenty of fruit and vegetables will give you lots of vitamins in your diet that will help you fight off infections. And increasing evidence in the winter months that you need to keep warm. Keep your house as warm as you can and as warm as that you can afford to heat. So keeping it up above 16 degrees is really important. And when you go out, wrap up warm. So the advice your grandmother gave you was right all along.
clearly we've come on in many ways since Alexander Fleming actually came across this mould and fungus growth and so on. But are we facing a kind of crisis in the middle of the 21st century whereby, you know, actually antibiotics, they won't produce that magic pill scenario, and it's not just sort of influenza and other elements that are sort of packaged through with this, but all sorts of viruses will begin to manifest with unfortunate results for us?
So I think, firstly, antibiotics aren't necessarily necessary for viruses because they don't treat them. They only treat bacteria. Mm. And what we're trying to say is that when you take an antibiotic, that you take it as prescribed by your doctor and you complete the course. But what we don't want you to do is take them when they're not needed. We want you to avoid that because that's when the unnecessary consequences will emerge.
And indeed, it's an important point you make there, Susan, in terms of sorting out the difference between bacteria, which cause things like meningitis, pneumonia, sepsis, and so on, and obviously, as you already said, the virus, which is constantly mutating from that point of view. Where can people go to find out more about Public Health England's views and aspects related to the survey, and indeed basic advice for the Keep Antibiotics Working campaign?
So there's lots of information available. If you type in Keep Antibiotics Working, you'll get onto lots of pages. And if you want to sign up to be an antibiotic guardian, where you can pledge to make some simple changes, then key in antibiotic guardian and you'll find lots of information there too.
And is this something which is likely to impact on different genders, different ages? I mean, is it something which actually, no, it's irrelevant whether you're kind of in the prime of your life or 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, or indeed 80s or 90s?
So I think we see that people in their 20s, 30s and 40s need less antibiotics, and the very young and the very elderly. So we need to keep the antibiotics for those that really need them. As we get older, because we've taken antibiotics and because we take them more frequently, we do see increased antibiotic resistance in the infections in the elderly. And so they make them even more difficult to treat. And those people are more defenceless from infections than the young and healthy.
And just coming to the end, really, can nutritional supplements, things like zinc, selenium, coenzyme Q10, can they actually help in terms of the overall diet? Because clearly there's so much processed food that's actually out there. Oftentimes we hear sort of scientific evidence for ensuring that you can improve your immune system by simply actually looking at the kind of minerals you're taking in your diet.
Well, I think eating lots of fresh fruit and vegetables are the key in that. And so we always advise that people take as many fresh fruit and vegetables as possible, eat healthily, and take 5 a day.
Susan Hopkins, healthcare epidemiologist, consultant for infectious diseases and microbiology, Public Health England. A nice short title, obviously, Susan, which is wonderful. Take care, and we'll speak again soon, I've no doubt.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful. And just ahead of the Siren news team coming in to do their news after the Sky News Centre, we just have to thank Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Lucy Jones, Paul Nelson, Susan Hopkins, Regina Tibble, Jeanette Schuchman, and of course Louis Savvy for joining us on the programme today, and of course Dr. Chris Dowes, and you, dear listener, for however long you've been part of the whole sequence. That's it. We're out of here with Mabel, featuring Kojo Funds and Finders Keepers. Happy Thursday, keep on enjoying life, and if you see any construction workers, well, tell them to actually increase the noise somewhat. It helps so wonderfully.